Let's all go to the
lava. Welcome to the Saturday Frights Podcast. I am the Projectionist, your co-host for this radio program. Now, come join your host, Vic Sage, as we enter the vault to once again discuss retro horror films and television programs.
Telling you just what Preston Griffith told me at lunch, Projectionist, some of the vault's library collection has been damaged by that darn ghoul fever-infected rat. Thankfully, Preston said it was confined to the Earl Stanley Gardner Perry Mason novels.
Thankfully? What is there to be thankful about in that case, Serge?
Sorry, I misspoke. Preston says we have duplicates in the vault storage, so the library didn't actually lose anything. But I'm telling you that at some point you are going to have to figure out what to do with that rat.
Perhaps it was merely a bookworm. Yes?
Come on now, Projectionist. You know that's not the case. Hey, look on the control panel. The recording light is on. Hi there, listeners, and thank you for returning for another matinee episode of the Saturday Frights podcast. The Projectionist and myself were talking about a little issue down here in the vault.
Something that could be described as creepy, dear listeners.
Nice segue there, my friend. The subject of this matinee show is the iconic Creepy Magazine. That black and white horror anthology magazine from Warren Publishing. Started back in 1964, actually.
Warren, you say? Surely you are not referring to Jim Warren, the publisher for the legendary Famous Monsters of Filmland from the dearly departed Forrest J. Ackerman.
The very one and the same, Projectionist. When I told you about the subject for this show, my friend, I was a little surprised you weren't more aware of this magazine.
I was a little busy at that time. What with the fire and everything at the haunted drive-in.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. Listeners, while 1964 was a little before my time, some of my earlier memories involve reading Creepy Magazine, as well as its sister publication, Eerie. At the time I was reading those, I was totally unaware that Warren Publishing produced another magazine, one that I think has most definitely managed to outshine both Creepy and Eerie, and that was Vampirella.
Really? I will admit, I too was unaware that character originated from Warren Publishing.
Yeah, the character totally did. When I was a kid, there was a local grocery store in my neck of the woods. It was an IGA, and they had this wonderful rack of magazines. Easily 50 or so. Although, interesting enough, they didn't carry comic books, which is what Creepy and Eerie essentially were. Anyway, when my father would go shopping after I was through looking at the dollar toys or trying to get the cereal with the best prize, I would wander over to the magazine shelves and look at stuff like Mad Magazine and Crazy. But it wasn't too long when I started noticing the beautifully painted and sometimes quite disturbing covers of the Creepy magazines.
Pray tell, Victor. How old were you at this point?
Oh, probably around 5 or maybe 6 years old. I really was a monster kid when growing up, so I would sit there, cross-legged on the floor, and read them. As I've mentioned on the Retroist site and the various podcasts, growing up, we really didn't have much money, so it was very rare that I could actually buy one. Maybe one every couple of months or so. It was definitely a treat when I was able to bring one of them home with me.
Were these age-appropriate stories? Your father had no qualms on you reading these horror tales.
He wasn't too worried about them, not really. He would flip through them himself first to be sure, however. Although, I do remember a night manager there that didn't take too kindly to me using the market as a library.
How so?
Well, I can recall not only comments made to me about it not being a library, I'm talking real hateful way of saying it too, but more than a few times, he would yank the magazine out of my hand. Here's the weird part. The thing that I remember most about him, he totally looked like Robert Reed. You know, Mike Brady from the Brady Bunch TV series. With less hair. Now, while this could be upsetting, I mean, especially at that age, I think when a kid is confronted with that type of reaction from an adult, they'll always feel bullied or ashamed. The truth is, the college-aged folks working there were totally cool with it. Some of these younger people would make sure to chat with me while I was reading. Obviously, those were better memories. Although, projectionist, I remember one particular instance where that night manager came up behind me, snatched the creepy magazine I was reading away, and took me by the arm, leading me through the store until he found my father in the frozen food aisle. This guy started raising his voice to my father. If you think I'm going to let your kid... And then he stopped because my father dropped his basket of groceries and was coming at us like a rocket. I've unfortunately seen my father angry a few times, and once or twice, I might have been the cause of it. And I can still remember his face going blood red as he stomped toward us. Long story short, the night manager let go of my arm very fast. And while my father would never have laid a finger on the man unless he hurt me, the entire store was filled with my father's, colorful metaphors. Immediately, the night manager had his hands up and backpedaled to get away from my father, who I might add, followed the night manager all the way back to the guy's office, just roaring at him.
Oh my.
I should add, we didn't end up buying anything that night.
I would imagine not. I wonder. Do you happen to recall, Victor, the very first issue you read of Creepy?
The first issue I recall seeing was issue 93. It was an all-sports issue and featured a mummy dressed up in a football uniform on a lime green background. I would later learn the artist responsible for that cover was Don Mates. I hope I'm pronouncing that last name properly. I'll be sure to share this particular cover over on The Retroist for this podcast post. That cover had some awesome blurbs on it, with murder on the hockey rink, aliens invade the baseball diamond, the mummy returns to the Super Bowl gridiron, the most unusual sports action ever shown. Each blurb finished with an exclamation point, of course. It was 68 pages that, as promised, was indeed the most unusual sports action. Not just the fact a mummy plays football and ends up helping the New York Jets win the game, but there was a boxer learning he was the best as he lay dying within the ring. A hockey player that used an elixir to help him get back on the ice after he's gotten too old. And then there was a pair of separated conjoined twins, psychically linked with one brother angry and resentful of the other for being in perfect health, forcing him to do terrible things. The stories themselves almost always had an introduction and ending by the pun-flinging character that I would later learn was named Uncle Creepy, a rail-thin host normally dressed in Victorian attire, although he would frequently be seen in appropriate outfits based on the story, too. Uncle Creepy also was balding with a wisp of hair on the top of his head, but the thing you remembered most was the intensity of his eyes, and a, no pun intended, very creepy grin.
It sounds quite a bit like EC Comics, The Crypt Keeper to me, dear boy.
Oh, it most certainly was an homage to those wonderful EC Comics of old. In fact, Russ Jones, an artist and one of the first editors for Creepy, was interviewed back in 2013. It was Jones who came up with the idea for Creepy, saying, quote, originally it was to be a 64-page magazine. Jim cut it back to 48. I made a sketch of my host for the mag and sent it off to Jack Davis to work up a cover. Still, no title. Titles are tough. Ask anyone who ever had to come up with one. One night, I was sitting in the studio alone looking at Woody's tear sheets from the ECs when Warren called. He was furious and demanded a name for Project D. I was looking at a balloon over on an Ingalls old witch, and in her narrative, the word creepy grabbed out at me. I muttered the name to Jim. We now had a title for our mag. End quote. You see, by going the black and white magazine route, listeners, Warren Publishing didn't have to worry about the Comic Code Authority. The code, created by the CMAA, the Comics Magazine Association of America, which got its start in September of 1954 to self-police comics, to not only help stamp down the uproar caused by Frederick Wortham's book, Seduction of the Innocent, from that same year, but in addition, it was created to make sure that the government didn't step in and start censoring all the various comic book companies' work.
Oh, yes. Now, I do recall reading of Frederick Wortham. I remember as well reading of how some cities held public burnings of Tales from the Crypt, Vault of Horror, and the Haunt of Fear, as well as the leading superhero periodicals of the day.
Yeah, I've seen some of that footage myself. Definitely upsetting. For what it's worth, the son of Max Gaines, the founder of EC Comics, this would be William Gaines, he helped get the Comics Magazine Association of America off the ground. But not in the way he'd intended, as the code they adopted would definitely be aimed at his own company's comics. So, he refused to join. Back to the subject of creepy, though. It feels to me, much like with the cosmic sense of karmic justice we've talked about before when covering the Twilight Zone. The same held true for not just Tales from the Crypt, but creepy and eerie stories. Although, as I recall it, there are a lot more stories where good people ended up badly in the Warren stories.
Did this magazine last very long?
19 years, projectionist. For 145 issues, although I should add that Warren Publishing was known to reprint stories frequently. Of course, since the magazine was an anthology format, you might get one or two reprinted stories and three new ones. Russ Jones acted as editor until 1965, and I've read online that he had something of a falling out with publisher Jim Warren and left. At this time, Archie Goodwin stepped up. He'd been writing most of the stories for Creepy anyway, which meant he was also on very good terms with the stable of artists that Warren was using. Goodwin's name should ring bells if you're a fan of comic books, because in his long list of accomplishments, he not only worked on Iron Man for Marvel Comics, but co-created Luke Cage. In addition, along with Roy Thomas, an artist Carmine Infantino spun the Star Wars adaptations into a full series. And if you were kind enough to listen to the second episode of the Pop Culture Retrorama podcast, he was the editor for James Robinson's Starman over at DC Comics. Sadly, he died in 1998 at the far too young age of 60 years old, but he really left behind an amazing legacy. 1 year after taking over editorial duties on Creepy, Goodwin and letterer Gaspar Saladino created a new horror magazine, a companion black and white comic magazine, also an anthology, called Eerie. I should point out that it started as an anthology series, but would later have a rotating cast of regular characters in long story arcs. Anyway, Goodwin said of the creation of the second magazine, quote, "We launched Eerie because we thought Creepy ought to have an adversary. The Laurel and Hardy syndrome always appealed to me. Creepy and Eerie are like Boris Karloff and Peter Lorre." End quote. So, Uncle Creepy now had a foil to verbally abuse, Cousin Eerie. Remember when I mentioned that Goodwin had a good working relationship with the artists that Warren hired for stories? They appear to be working freelance. See if any of these names ring a bell. Bernie Wrightson, Neil Adams, Frank Frazetta, Steve Ditko, Joe Orlando, Reed Crandall, Angelo Torres, Al Williamson, Alex Toth, Gray Morrow, and Wally Wood, to name a few. I am sad to say, though, the good times would hit a snag in 1967, when not only did Archie Goodwin leave Warren Publishing, but many of those artists I just named did as well.
What was the reason cited for them leaving the company?
A pretty good one. Lack of money. So after they left, for 3 years, the magazines kind of went into reprint city. That is, until Vampirella hit, and the popularity of that magazine gave a much-needed financial boost. Goodwin would return for a couple of issues. Since he was working at Marvel at that point, I suppose he didn't need the extra workload. Frazetta, Wood, and Crandall also would make a return. Now, to be fair, not all of the stories were fantastic, friends, but they succeeded more than they failed, and left some memorable stories behind. While I think it's safe to say that Creepy never matched the popularity of Tales from the Crypt, the fact of the matter is, much like the latter, Uncle Creepy has made a comeback. For one thing, the rights to both Creepy and Eerie, which had been tied up in legal red tape, were resolved. And beginning in 2008, in a partnership with Dark Horse Comics, they released the first archive edition, a beautiful and pricey hardcover edition that will eventually collect all of the Creepy magazine and Eerie stories. Also, in 2009, Dark Horse Comics began to produce a new Creepy comic book series.
Don't be shy. Step a little closer. I've been waiting to welcome you and your friends. The name is Creepy. Uncle Creepy. I have much to tell. All the classic horror and sci-fi from Creepy and Eerie magazines, plus shocking new tales in Creepy comic book. It's enough to make someone scream. What a coincidence. Let's step inside, shall we?
Now, what you just heard, friends, was from a pretty awesome bit of stop-motion animation by none other than Stephen Chiodo. Yes, one of the Chiodo brothers responsible for the effects on Critters, Critters 2, and bringing us the amazing 1988 film Killer Clowns from Outer Space. To say nothing of his stop-motion work on films like 1985's Pee-wee's Big Adventure, where he brought us the memorable Large Marge scene, or even the dinosaur attack-inspired commercial for the SUX 5000, the car of the future during the commercial break of 1987's RoboCop. I actually did an article on the Uncle Creepy Returns commercial in the past on the Retroist, but I will make sure to embed the video for your viewing pleasure on the podcast post. All right, listeners, it's time, with the help of that vintage wonder known as the Retroist Vault XJ13 computer.
The wonder, dear listeners, is how intern Rockford J manages to keep this mechanical monstrosity functioning.
Ahem. As I was saying, with the aid of the XJ13 computer, we have a list of the top 5 creepy stories not to miss. Number 5 is the Bernie Wrightson adaptation of Edgar Allan Poe's The Black Cat. Wrightson's wonderfully detailed ink and brushwork suits Poe's 1843 tale of guilt and madness. His panels leap off the page with certain sequences, as when the narrator kills his poor wife with an axe, or the horror of finding the grisly discovery of the black cat perched atop her head, where he walled up her corpse. Deliciously disturbing artwork is perhaps the best way to describe it. Number 4 is yet another Bernie Wrightson offering. I promise you that all of these are not Wrightson. This short story is entitled The Muck Monster, and boiling it down, it's basically a different telling of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. Which, to be honest, you might think of this as a test for his exceptional illustrated version of that novel that was originally released in 1983. With The Muck Monster, we are introduced to a scientist that is very much like Dr. Frankenstein. But in this case, he believes he has failed in bringing life to his creation. Sadly, for his creation, that is not the case. He just isn't able to move or communicate at the time of his birth, which makes it all the more horrible when the scientist rages, cutting up his creation and dumping the parts in an acid bath, before draining the remains from his workshop that mixes with the grave dirt of the local cemetery. Later that night, the muck monster rises to confront his creator for his actions, but his appearance is too much for the scientist and drives the creator mad. In a moving scene, the muck monster climbs to the top of a hill to overlook the serenity, the beauty of the village below, and rests himself next to a tree, where he sits until the seasons strip him to the bone. Number 3 is Lycanthropist. In this story by Bud Lewis, with artwork by Bill Drought, the town of Strigosha in Vermont has a big problem and a bigger mystery. First of all, the town receives a large shipment of boxes, sent by the Psychogenetic Research Center. This little town gets a nasty surprise when next all of the electricity goes out. Then we find out the townsfolk of Strigosha are distrustful of strangers, which is probably a bad time for Dr. Adam Newman to show up. But you see, he is a lycanthropist, and he has arrived to help the town with a real problem, a plague of werewolves. Everything is not as it appears in this town. The people living there are the werewolves, and they are quite ready to make Dr. Newman's stay very brief. with a werewolf leaping up to rip his throat out, only to find that this stranger in town isn't human himself, but a robot. The first robotic AI, in fact. And he makes short work in subduing the villagers. With the help of the silver injections he is scratching them with. Not to cure them, as it turns out. Because he's taking every single member of Strigosha back to the Psychogenetic Research Center. So that the advanced computers and new robots can learn how to use the cure of lycanthropy to force the human race to de-evolve out of existence.
Some rather dark endings in these tales, Victor. You read all of them as a small child. This actually goes a long way in explaining what is wrong with you.
I did not read all of these stories as a kid, but thankfully I was able to pick up back issues at my local comic shop over the years. Plus, those creepy archive editions when I can afford them, projectionist. Number two is, oh, we have a great one here, Monster Rally, written by Archie Goodwin with artwork by Angelo Torres. As the story begins, we are introduced to a ghoul on the run from an angry mob. He is given shelter in the carriage of a passing hunchback, only to find himself the prisoner of one Dr. Habeas. The hunchback is named Drakow, by the way. The not-so-good doctor is using the notebooks of the legendary Dr. Frankenstein, not to just randomly create life, but to try to find a way to make himself immortal. In the dungeons of the doctor's castle, there is a menagerie of monsters. A witch, a werewolf, a mummy, and a vampire, which apparently has managed to escape the dungeon, which has the effect of bringing the villagers to the castle, slaying Drakow as he tries to protect Dr. Habeas before burning the entire thing down, killing all the monsters who had been freed, who turned on their captor as the flames engulfed them. And yet, the doctor before his death was able to create a perfect formula. And while it was lost in the fire, the chemicals mixed with the remains of the monsters themselves and birthed Uncle Creepy. Monster Rally is an origin story, and in that last panel we are treated to a baby Creepy crawling through the remains of the castle. At last, we have our number one story as chosen by the XJ13 Vault computer, and that is The Duel of the Monsters. Once again, by both Archie Goodwin and Angelo Torres. In this tale, we are witness to a horrible werewolf attack in a sleepy little Spanish village. The arm of the law on the scene is Sergeant Vega. As we have pointed out in these stories so far, many times things aren't quite what they seem. Vega is a vampire, which is why he works the night patrol, of course. It's a duel between these two monsters as they meet. But for Vega, who is able to wound the werewolf, driving it off, the question is, which of the villagers is the lycanthrope? After being relieved by his second-in-command, the sergeant suspects Alfonso, the night watchman at the cemetery, of being the werewolf. And so, he sneaks into the man's home to await his return. To be surprised to find a very angry werewolf already there. The two fight to the death. And, to Vega's shock, as the werewolf dies before him, it was Ruiz, his second-in-command. This is when Alfonso enters his home, grinning widely with a mouth full of sharp teeth. You see, he happens to be a ghoul, and he lured the werewolf and vampire into a fight so they would take each other out, and he could have a giant feast.
I am rather surprised that these stories from Creepy Magazine have failed to be turned into a television series, or better yet, a film.
Well, there have been attempts, I believe, but nothing concrete. Although, I'm sure that if we give it time, it will happen. Perhaps HBO needs that perfect horror anthology again. With that, I think we've come to the end of our Saturday Frights matinee episode for Warren Publishing's Creepy Magazine, at least for the time being. After all, with 145 issues having been published, we just might have to do another top five from time to time. Friends, the music you heard at the beginning and ending of our podcast was provided by Peachy. If you have musical needs, you can contact him at peachy@retroist.com. My co-host, the Projectionist, has his own Facebook page, Projectionist Haunted Drive-In. He generally shares old movie posters and newspaper advertisements throughout the week. It's always neat to see what vintage thing he can dig up to share. As for myself, you can still find me posting a couple of times a day on not just the Saturday Frights Facebook page, but the Diary of an Arcade Employee Facebook page too, as well as the Retroist site. I even managed to find time to share some things on the Retroist Clubhouse on Facebook now and again. If you'd like to contact me with suggestions for future episodes, you can reach me at VicSage@Retroist.com. And listeners, if you like the show, consider subscribing and giving us a rating over on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify. It helps us to spread the word. Of course, we owe a great deal of gratitude to the Retroist himself, not just for hosting the podcast, but for creating a place where we can all share in our love of things retro. So when you need your retro fix, and we all do, make sure to visit The Retroist. Now, next week, we will be presenting a normal episode of the Saturday Frights podcast, and the projectionist and myself will be discussing the 1986 Twilight Zone episode entitled Grandma, an adaptation of the Stephen King short story of the same name. Until next time, the vault is sealed.
This has been a Retroist production. Sleep well, and goodbye.